from NATO and the U.S.
Qu'est-ce que c'est qu'une Europe puissance politique?
What's a politically powerful Europe with no diplomatic and military means to carry out its decisions, said Sarkozy. The French president said Europeans must be able to deploy, at minimum, a force of 60,000 men to any corner of the globe. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
Hundreds of same-sex couples in California are due to get married today after the state Supreme Court ruling legalizing same-sex marriage took effect yesterday at the close of business. Several county clerk offices are opening early and closing late to meet the expected demand for marriage licenses. Two counties say they'll only issue marriage licenses but won't perform marriages. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org.
WILL depends on listeners like you for 38% of the money it takes to keep programs like the one you're listening to now on the air. If you haven't renewed your membership this year, please do so by June 30th, the end of our fiscal year, and help us raise the remaining $396,000 to end the year on track and bring you more great programs in the coming fiscal year. Mail a check to 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, 61801, or give online at willpledge.org. And thanks.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting more Summer Studio Theater Company, as well as the Summer Solstice Celebration on June 20th, featuring a Star Lab and live music. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll reach into the Focus archives for a conversation that we first broadcast in March. This is an interview with Colin Grant. We talked about his recently published biography of Marcus Garvey. So for this hour of Focus 580, as you listen, do keep in mind that we'll be not taking calls. At one time, Marcus Garvey was the most famous black man on earth. He was flamboyant and charismatic. He founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association. At one time, the association had millions of members around the world. He was also important in the Pan-African Back to Africa movement, also started the Black Star line of ships. Some people in his time saw him as a dangerous radical, but others considered him the Black Moses. In this hour of the show, we'll talk a little bit about his life and times, and our guest is Colin Grant. He was born in Jamaica. He and his parents immigrated to Britain in the 50s. He began his professional life studying medicine, but after 5 years turned in a completely new direction, and he became a playwright. In 1989, he joined the BBC, where he's worked as a script editor and producer of arts programs on the BBC World Service, and he is the author of a newly published biography, the first full-length biography of Garvey in some time. The title of the book is Negro with a Hat, The Rise and Fall of Marcus Garvey, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So either way, if you're here in our immediate area and can use that first number, or it would be a long-distance call and use the second, either way, your comments and questions are welcome. We just ask people to try to be brief, and we just ask that to make it possible for us to move along and accommodate as many callers as possible. But again, questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Grant, hello.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me on the program.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. I really have the opportunity, appreciate having the opportunity to learn more about Marcus Garvey and to bring that to our listeners. It certainly seems to me that you might be hard-pressed to find someone where opinions, that is, assessments of him varied so widely to the point that some people thought that he was a joke, a figure to be ridiculed, and others probably would have followed him anywhere. As I said, I have a hard time thinking of somebody else that would provoke that kind of diversity of response.
I agree. That was partly the interest in writing the book because, as you say, To some people, he was a prophet. He was a saint. He was revered. He was a god. Amongst his followers, there was God and there was Garvey. And yet for others, he was a buffoon. He was a charlatan. And I start my book in 1940. In a way, my book is written almost like a film. I started at the end, and then we kind of spool forward to the very beginning. And in 1940, Marcus Garvey was alone in London. By then, he was a broken man. His movement had failed. The millions of followers had fallen away, largely. His wife had come to London with him in 1937 or thereabouts, but she'd become fed up with him and had left with the children. So in 1940, at the beginning of the year, he has a stroke. He's recovering from the stroke. And then in May 1940, in this drafty, cold house, rented house in West London, the war's begun. In this drafty house, he sits alone and his secretary brings him the newspapers. And his eyes cast over the headlines of the Chicago Defender newspaper. And he reads a headline which he knows cannot be true. The headline is, Marcus Garvey dies in London. And the obituary is not a kind obituary. It's a caustic obituary. He's ravaged in the obituary. And subsequent obituaries are then published. More newspapers get to hear about Marcus Garvey's death, so-called death. And they equally publish obituaries. And Marcus Garvey, after reading so many of these obituaries, although his secretary tries to hide some of the more brutal ones from him, because some of these obituaries are saying he was a charlatan, he was a buffoon, he was a disgrace to the race. And after reading all of these obituaries, Marcus Garvey has a second heart attack and dies. His obituaries kill him. Hmm. And to me, I was astonished when I learned that story, because the man who wrote the first obituary was a man, George Padmore, who was a great Pan-Africanist. And you would imagine that someone like he would be an ally of Garvey. And yet Garvey had a great many friends who were black, but equally he had a great many enemies who were black, and particularly in the institution of the NAACP, his great enemy, his nemesis, W.E.B. Du Bois, I think loathed Garvey. And when I began to research the book, I was astonished about the way that both men actually at some stage descended into the mire and they waded through a kind of molasses of hate. Some of the things that they wrote about each other through their newspapers and magazines, The Negro World on Garvey's behalf and The Crisis on Du Bois' behalf, are almost unrepeatable. And so that was the crux of the matter. I wanted to write a book that sought to get to the bottom of this great conundrum. Why was he despised and revered in equal measure?
And perhaps we should mention the title of the book. This is drawn from something that Du Bois said derisively about Marcus Garvey. He was the one who said, "Oh, he's just a Negro with a hat."
Yeah, that's a paraphrase. I mean, he said actually much worse things. When Garvey was up against it, and when the NAACP stalwarts like Du Bois and Robert Bagnall turned against him, they led what was called a Garvey Must Go campaign. And Bagnall said of Garvey, he was a Negro of unmixed stock with bright pig-like eyes and a bulldog face. And later on in the crisis, Du Bois was to write of Garvey that he was either a lunatic or a traitor. And he called him a little fat black man, ugly, with a big head seated on a pink throne. And so my title, Negro with Hat, is a kind of suggests that kind of dismissive nature that the likes of Du Bois and Bagnall and Pickens had towards Garvey. But equally, you see, as you mentioned in your splendid introduction, he led the Universal Negro Improvement Association. This was a word that he embraced, Negro. And in 1920, in the kind of flush of excitement in August, Garvey led 25,000 of his followers from their headquarters in Harlem to Madison Square Garden, where he would eventually be proclaimed the provisional president of Africa. He had a rather high opinion of himself. But at that convention, a month-long convention, they published a Declaration of Rights for the Negro Peoples of the World. And one of the things that they said that they would do is that they would thenceforth never answered to the word N-I-G-G-E-R. Hmm. They would only answer to the word Negro with a capital N. And when Garvey wore his fantastic military regalia on his parades, when he put on his fantastic bicornet helmet with plumes in the top of it, I imagine him as a proud Negro with a hat. He famously said, "Why should the great Western imperial powers have a monopoly on this kind of presentation, this kind of military Victorian presentation with wonderful gold epaulettes, bicornet hats? Why cannot the black man adopt the same uniforms? Why can he not adopt the same ideas of authority?" And so Garvey would have seen himself as a proud Negro with a hat, but equally, that phrase can be seen as a dismissive one, as a poor buffoon Negro masquerading in a hat. So I wanted a title that suggested both, because that's the kind of central kernel of the idea of the book, to investigate those poles of opinion.
Yeah. I'd like to introduce just very quickly again our guest, Colin Grant. He's an independent historian. He works for BBC Radio and is the author of a new biography of Marcus Garvey. The title of the book indeed is Negro with a Hat, The Rise and Fall of Marcus Garvey, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit just at the beginning about one of the unique things or interesting things about him. It was just how polarizing he was, or at least when people talked about him in his time, you got these very, very different sorts of assessments. And I think also the story about his death in 1940 tells you something perhaps also about the arc of his life. Mm-hmm. When you think about the fact that when he was born in Jamaica, he certainly was not born to wealth or privilege. When he was at the height of his fame in the 20s, he was indeed known around the world, and I think one could certainly make the argument that he was the most famous black man on earth, and that then he would, it might even surprise people that he was still alive in 1940, but that yes, certainly he was in decline, both in terms of his image and his influence and his health. All of that says something about how far he went, both literally and figuratively, over the course of his life.
I agree, and what I was at pains to do was to try to chart that arc of his life, because it is a remarkable life. David, he was born in penury in a small village on the north coast of Jamaica, St. Anne's Bay. And his father was a stonemason. His mother, she planted crops, pimento, coffee. And I'm also very keen to give a sense of what life would have been like, because Garvey has become, for some people, a kind of divine figure, and when you have that kind of adoration, the real man gets lost. So factually, he was rather a rascal as a young boy, and I came across a story that when he was seven, he and his posse of friends were caught stoning the glass Wesleyan church. They broke all the windows in the church, and they were brought in front of a judge and found to be guilty. And the judge turned to Garvey's father and said, "Well, Mr. Garvey, we can either send the boy to reform school, or you can pay a £1 fine, about $2. And in those days, that was a lot of money. And Garvey's rather austere father said, "Send the boy to reform school." Garvey was saved by his rather saintly mother, who jumped in and passed the hat round and managed to get the funds together to prevent her son from going to reform school. And I wanted to get a sense that he was, even at that age, wedded to an idea of himself, because he was this kind of leader of the gang, as it were, and his first wife, a woman called Amy Ashwood, who wrote an unpublished memoir of Garvey called Portrait of a Liberator, describes that he would conduct his own little sermons with his followers at seven, even. And he was always a man, or rather a boy, who sought knowledge, who sought to improve himself. And I was struck by the title of his organization, the Universal Negro Improvement Association. Garvey strived for improvement, and improvement began at home. So as a young man, moving from the countryside to the capital, Kingston, he sought to improve his diction. He took elocution lessons. And so wedded was he to this idea of self-improvement that he entered a statewide elocution competition, which he thought he would do very well. In fact, he thought he would probably come first. But when he got up to speak, he was heckled and jeered, and he came third. And so disappointed and incensed was he about this transgression that he sued the heckler, and he won. And it struck me that this is a kind of motif that I could play out again and again in the book, because he had a very strange relationship with the courts. Maybe rather like a lot of Caribbean people, they don't tend to resolve problems locally. They go straight to litigation. And again, you see Garvey going to courts or being taken to court to the extent that, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but you know, when the Black Star Line failed and he was accused of mail fraud, and he made a big mistake, I think, in defending himself. They always say that the man who defends himself has a fool for a client. And Garvey, this great orator who, in his peak, as you rightly say, David, could command an audience of thousands of people. I mean, in his headquarters at Liberty Hall, regularly, each week, twice, three times a week, thousands of people, 2,000-3,000 of people would pour in to hear him speak. And when he spoke, he had a voice like thunder. He had a voice like God. It was as if he was a conduit for God to the people who felt that they heard their own thoughts articulated through him. But he made the mistake of when he went to court, he couldn't moderate his voice. He couldn't temper his voice to accommodate the fact that he was now in a court with just 12 people. And so he had this sort of big, booming theatrical presentation, which rather annoyed and irritated the court, I think. And he was eventually found guilty of mail fraud and sent to jail. And partly, I think, it was because of his own sense of drama, own sense of importance, that he didn't realise that he should perhaps have been more humble at that instance, and suggested that perhaps his failings were the failings of a human being. Because I don't think ultimately that he was a crook. I think he was sincere. But he allowed people to come into his organisation who took him for a ride.
I'm very interested in the idea that, again, even though he came from disadvantaged circumstances, that one of the things that was very important in his home were books. His father apparently had a significant collection of books that would have been maybe unusual for someone at his social level. And so it would seem from a very early age that Marcus was very interested in books, in ideas, in reading. And also one wonders what it is in a person that gives them the idea at a young age that they're destined for something very important. It seemed that maybe indeed he had a feeling like that.
I think he must have. I mean, his father was a kind of local scholar. And as you say rightly, it's unusual that a man of his standing would have had a library, which he did. And he rather kept the library to himself, although Garvey, as a young man, would break into the library and devour the books. Garvey would learn 3 or 4 words a day and write them down, put them in his pocket, bring them out and try to use those words in sentences. And his friends describe that as a young man in and around this small town, St. Anne's Bay, he would walk around the town as if he was in a campus at a university with his hands in his pockets or reading with his coattails flying behind him and reciting passages from books. And I think at an early age he saw the great power of words and came to love words. I mean, he had a great love of learning. And when he moves as a young man in 1912 to London, he would have been about 25. Again, he has nothing. He's poor, he's destitute, and he spends a lot of his time in the British Museum, in the library of the British Museum, devouring the books and reading works like the works of Wilmot Blyden. Blyden was a great Liberian scholar, and he wrote a big book on Christianity, Islam and the Negro race. But Garvey also read works of Booker T. Washington I mean, he read Up from Slavery, and that was one of the books, I think, that turned him into a man who thought that he could do something for his race, as he perceived himself to be a race leader, because he said once he read that book, the idea of himself as being a race leader crystallized. And so I think with the learning, with the interest in printmaking, he became a printer as a young man, I think he was wedded to this idea that this was a tool which he could use to educate, inform, and entertain. And again, you see that he wasn't just a great speaker. He was a man who understood how we could use language to articulate the submerged thoughts of a repressed but awakening.
Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about the origins of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, which was, this was his, the crystallization of his idea that that African people and people of African descent, no matter where they were, could and should join together and take advantage of the kind of power that would come from that kind of unity. Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about where that idea came from.
Well, famously, he says in his small memoir, Mugabe published a little biography of himself, actually, when he was first incarcerated. He talks about the fact that when he was in London, he got this great idea to lead a people. And on the boat going back from London, going back from England via Southampton, back to Jamaica, he has a kind of epiphany, tossing and turning in his bed. He thinks to himself, where is the black man's army? Where is the black man's king? Where is the black man's navy? He couldn't ever see one. And he thought to himself, rather grandly, in that kind of marvelous way that titanic men seem to have these marvelous titanic visionary ideas, there wasn't one, and he would form one. And he started off very small. He started off in Jamaica. When he got back to Jamaica in 1914, he formed the first branch of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And essentially, it was just him and a few friends. He was very lucky early on to come into contact with a fiery, young, bright woman called Amy Ashwood, who was 17 at the time. And they formed the core of the movement. And it's quite interesting, David, that people have this idea that Garvey was a great separatist. He became one, but he wasn't a separatist early on, because a lot of the people he courted favours from in Jamaica were white. They were part of the white elite. They were pastors. He even courted the governor. And in Jamaica in 1914, 1915, as the great British Empire went to war against Germany, Garvey was at pains with his fledgling movement to pledge allegiance to the king. And he got into trouble, actually, because as the movement grew, it didn't grow very large. At its height in Jamaica, they had maybe 100 followers. But when the funds came into the organization, rather than dispensing it to the poor and feeding the poor on Christmas Day, perhaps, and giving them some food and perhaps little presents, a lot of the money was sent and spent, rather, by writing and sending expensive telegrams to the king on his birthday, celebrating his birthday, but also pledging the loyalty of the Universal Negro Improvement Association to the crown in its great struggle against the Germans. And again, you see the way that actually Garvey was pushed on by Amy Ashwood. Amy Ashwood was a remarkable woman, again, of indomitable spirit, rather like Garvey. And together, they were an unstoppable force. And what I was pleased to discover was that he had a great romantic streak. And I was fortunate enough to go to California, where the one unpublished memoir of Amy Ashwood is kept by Robert Hill in UCLA, and read firsthand some of her stories about the fact that Garvey was a great man of gesture. And it didn't just occur when he led parades and led his huge movement. He was a great man of romantic gesture. He loved in a grand way, she says. And although they were engaged secretly, Garvey was egging her on always to own up to their engagement. And she, as a young lady of 17, was rather overwhelmed by the strength of his passion. And she talks about the fact that one day she decides to break off the engagement, and she writes a note to him and goes about her way. And she comes home to find a note from him pushed under her door. And the note says, "I'm going to throw myself into the sea and kill myself." And Ashwood, rather petrified, rushes to the beach, to the part of the beach where they famously would walk hand in hand, and finds him wading into the water, and obviously saves him, and their engagement is renewed. And I tell you that story because I think sometimes we lose sight of the fact that although he was wedded to his movement, he was also wedded to the idea of romance. He was a very romantic man, also, as you might imagine from that telling, a rather melodramatic man. And when the organization then went to America, I think he was fortunate to arrive in America at a time when there was a great new tradition of the street orators in Harlem. In 1917, there was a unseasonably warm spring, and men, women went out onto the streets. And at 135th Street, men like Asa Philip Randolph and Hubert Harrison would put out their stepladders, stand to the top of the steps and speak. And they spoke magnificently about some of the trials and tribulations of black people in Harlem and in America at that time. And Garvey learnt from these people. But Garvey also learnt, as I say in my book, from Billy Sunday, I think, because Billy Sunday, as you know, the great evangelist, again, a fantastic speaker. And Garvey went to see him in his tabernacle in New York. And Billy Sunday could speak to thousands of people without the benefit of amplification. And again, could speak in a way which touched the souls and hearts of people, a very physical speaker, a very physical orator. So Garvey, on the one hand, had the elocution lessons. He learned from Billy Sunday. He learned from the Harlem Ebony Sages, as they called themselves, these great orators. And he learned from the black pastors that he saw when he traveled around America in 1916 and 1917. So that when he came to found his organization in Harlem, the first organization of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, he was pretty well versed in the art of oration. And his ascendancy was timely also because, again and again, if you look in the literature, the black man and woman wasn't doing very well in America at that time, and there was a feeling that they needed someone like Garvey to come along, because Garvey came along after Booker T. Washington had died, and there was a kind of gap, as it were. The man who filled the gap, he thought, was W.E.B. Du Bois. But Du Bois was a rather cold, austere figure who couldn't touch people in the way that Garvey could. And I think that became the seed of the problem between Garvey and Du Bois, the fact that Garvey could articulate these thoughts and reach out to the common man. And Du Bois, I think, and a lot of people like Du Bois, felt that he was stealing their thunder.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. Our guest is Colin Grant. He's an independent historian who works for BBC Radio, and he is the author of a newly published biography of Marcus Garvey. The title of his book is Negro with a Hat, The Rise and Fall of Marcus Garvey, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit earlier, touched on the fact that he, and as well as some other people, were involved in starting the Black Star Line, passenger ship line. He also was involved in other kinds of business as well. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about his interest in black entrepreneurship.
Yes, well, I think Garvey did a tour of America, of 38 states, in about 6 months when he first arrived, and he saw that there were black entrepreneurs around and there were black businesses, people like Madam C.J. Walker. He was inspired by people like her, the great beautician who manufactured hair straightening products. And she became, if we are to believe her press, she became a millionaire. So there were black entrepreneurs around, but actually in Harlem, there weren't many black businesses. There were some, and often those black businesses were fronted by black people, but they weren't actually run by black people. And you could say that slavery had not been a great preparation for entrepreneurship. And Garvey, I think, as a Caribbean man, as a man of the British Empire, recognized the huge importance of having a mercantile tradition. But also, it was a great era of shipbuilding, the great era of trading through ships. So Garvey romantically saw the buying of a ship and the starting of a Black Star Line as a great boost, not just to the idea of commerce, but to the idea of what would be possible. Eventually, the ships became propaganda tools. But I think the problem that Garvey had with that enterprise was that he allowed into his organization, he had a kind of open door, and he was attracted to people like himself who were self-made, really, self-educated. And as there were few opportunities for bright people like Garvey and some of the people who came into the organization, like Hubert Harrison and Wilfred Domingo, these are people who are doing jobs in the post office, perhaps, as clerks. And so here was a great opportunity for them to flex their intellectual muscles, flex their commercial muscles, and show what they could do. But sadly, Garvey was naive in that he had no great business experience. And he was naive in that he assumed that all of the black people who came into the organization felt like he did, that they were going to uplift the race. So one of the great tragedies and one of the great characters, almost kind of Machiavellian or Iago-like character in the great play Othello, was the captain, Richardson. So Garvey needed someone who knew about ships, who would be able to help him purchase the first ship. And along came this man, Richardson, one of the few black people in America who had a license to be a captain. But what he didn't realize was that Richardson offered to purchase a ship for him, to act as a broker. And in American parlance, Richardson was working both sides of the street. So the first ship that they bought should have been bought for about $26,000. They ended up paying $165,000 for it. And the ship that they bought was a leaky old rust bucket, actually. More work needed to be done on the ship to actually make it seaworthy. So they were on a hiding for nothing right from the word go. And one of the great tragedies of Garvey is that men and women, but mostly men, came into the organization like Richardson, and they fleeced Garvey. They fleeced the Black Star Line. And Garvey famously said many years later, when things had gone rather dark and the shipping line had failed, that he gave every black person of seniority a chance to make their name in the Black Star Line, and every black person of seniority who came in fleeced the Black Star Line. So, I mean, I think Garvey, I think, was fundamentally a great promoter, and it was famously said also that he was the first black man who sold the idea of the black man to himself. And I think the problem that he had was that the ships became far too much of a propaganda tool rather than an actual solvent business.
We have a caller who'd like to join in our conversation here. Let's do that. The caller is in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about the relationship between the Universal Negro Advancement Association and the NAACP. Did the NAACP follow Garvey's association, or did it overlap? If it overlapped, it may have been the NAACP started up in opposition to his group, or if it came afterwards, it may have done that to replace it, in which case Garvey really acted as a stimulus for the NAACP.
Well, the NAACP was started around about 1908, I believe.
It was? Okay.
Yeah, so it started before Garvey. It drew on the same constituency in a way. The problem that Garvey had with the NAACP was that the people who were largely in control of the NAACP, the brown elite who were in charge together with their white colleagues, they were Ivy League type fellows. And they famously, through W.E.B. Du Bois, led this idea of the talented tenth. They were the 10% of the black population who were going to lead the charge. They would be the avant-garde, and they would integrate mainstream America, and they would bring along the 90% others with them. So they were kind of a top-down organization, and I think the problem for them was that they didn't like Garvey's bottom-up organization. Yeah. So for many years, actually, you could have dual membership of the NAACP and the UNIA. But things became rather rough in the mid-1920s. And in a way, I wrote an essay recently comparing Barack Obama to Marcus Garvey. And it's quite interesting to see the way that they share a sense of being great orators, and they share a sense of being criticized for their great speechifying. They're distrusted for being able to talk the talk, but their critics would say, well, is there any substance? And equally, they're distrusted. I think Garvey was distrusted because he was an outsider. And I think Barack Obama, initially amongst some black elders, has been distrusted because he was perceived as an outsider, someone who hadn't suffered in the way that they had, who hadn't ridden the freedom buses, who hadn't been on the marches, and had this new constituency delivered to him. And I think it's a great tragedy that Garvey's movement and the UNA and the UNIA and the NAACP, they couldn't get their act together. And so actually they kind of fought pitch battles amongst each other when the animosity became really bad. And they divided the vote. So a man called Samuel Redding talks about the fact that in some parts of America where black people could vote and could send politicians to Congress, they didn't get in because the vote was split.
All right. I hope that gets at the question of the caller. We have another also in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Yes. I want to comment on your comparison of Barack Obama to Marcus Garvey. And I believe he's more or less along the lines of the captain of Garvey's ship who kind of like fleeced them in a sense, because I don't believe that Barack Obama has started from the bottom up as Marcus Garvey. He kind of comes in from the top down. He hasn't done any really grassroots organizing. He kind of comes in on the backs of other people and really inserting himself into the black community to gain automatic support. And I believe this is like the best example of this falling apart is the controversy with his pastor, because he distanced himself from very true things that the pastor says about the racial condition in America. But in order to contain and keep the support of so-called white liberals, he distanced himself from the truth, right? Yeah. So I think that's a great example of how Barack Obama is not like Marcus Garvey.
Sure, I accept your point. I was making the comparison purely in terms of the way that I perceive as a man coming from the other side of the water, that he seems to have excited amongst some black people some resentment. And I suppose I was trying to make that point, that there are certain people who were in positions of authority who, I feel, the way that I read it from this side of the pond, have felt threatened by Barack Obama in the same way that I feel that Garvey caused people to feel threatened by him. I mean, in that simple way, and you probably understand the lay of the land in America about what presently is going on better than I.
Our guest, let me just mention again, we have about 15 minutes left, and our guest is Colin Grant. He's an independent historian who works for the BBC, for BBC Radio. He is the author of a newly published biography, The Rise and Fall of Marcus Garvey. That's the subtitle. The title of the book is Negro with a Hat, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to come back to Garvey. We talked a little bit about the fact that within the black community, people saw him very differently. Within the white community, it seems, at least if you talk about people that were within the power structure of the white community, they saw him as being someone who was very dangerous, and that there was some effort to get something on him, which eventually did lead to this probably spurious charge of mail fraud. But maybe you can talk a little bit more about how it is that that people within the white power structure thought about Marcus Garvey.
Well, early on, and unbeknownst to him, he made an enemy of J. Edgar Hoover, who was a fledgling member of what became the FBI. And Garvey, you have to remember, David, came to the fore towards the end of the First World War. And this is a war in which hundreds of thousands of black doughboys went to Europe. And people like Hoover and members of the administration worried that they were learning some rather un-American ideas over in France and Germany, where they were fighting. And they came back with ideas of socialism, perhaps. I mean, Garvey mistakenly was considered a red. And Garvey started to attract attention during the Great Red Scare. So anyone who was perceived to be less than a 100% American Democrat, who could perhaps lead people to revolt against their present condition, was considered to be dangerous and a red. And so a file on Garvey was started fairly early on. And fairly early on, the FBI infiltrated the UNIA. And there's some wonderful work that's been done by a man called Theodore Kornwiebel, who wrote a book called Seeing Red. Now, I take my hat off to Theodore, where he explores the degree to which, in some key positions, the FBI, or rather at that point it was called the Bureau of Investigation, had key personnel who were writing daily reports. And they weren't going to be helping the organization. They were doing everything they could to undermine the organization. Garvey also made enemies of the British and the French and the Italians, because they had empires and colonies in Africa. And the British and the French especially were worried when Garvey's Back to Africa idea began to take hold in the imaginations of black people. They were worried that the idea would also take hold in the minds of black Africans in Africa. And so that when, if it ever came to pass that Garvey and his people were to start a new African empire in Liberia, which is their aim, those ideas might then infect the neighbouring states of Togo and Sierra Leone, which are run by the British and the French. And so the British military intelligence also infiltrated Garvey's organisation. And although he made a kind of pact with the Ku Klux Klan in 1924, he had no friends amongst the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, that was a very strange decision, which I think perhaps he later came to rue. But I say this because it seems that Garvey had so many enemies also in the administration, so many enemies in white organizations like the Ku Klux Klan, which he didn't really take too great cognizance of. And the great tragedy, I think, is that he mistook the antipathy of the NAACP. He mistook them as the real enemy, where I feel that the real enemy were the people in authority who saw Garvey as a great Negro agitator, and they were petrified about what he might do to create civil unrest.
We have some other callers. We'll try to get them in here in the time that remains. Next, someone in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. That was a fascinating thing. It almost distracted me from my question, this idea of this great power infiltration into the movement and the early role for Hoover. But I wanted to ask about the idea that the whole Back to Africa idea was seen as controversial in the sense that Ku Klux Klan wanted to get Africans here back to Africa too. Lincoln actually signed something called the Negro Removal Office. He signed money over to it when it hadn't been authorized by the Congress, so it was actually outside of the constitutional law. But the idea was that I think the NAACP and others felt that we really don't have another home. We are isolated from Africa. It isn't really going back home. That a lot of blood, sweat, and tears were invested in this country, not paid for, et cetera, extracted from Africans who were here, and that they should stand and fight and claim full citizenship here rather than this other pernicious racial notion of they are full men, but they're only full men on their own soil, which apparently was a dimension of racial consciousness and ideology of the time. How would you respond to that?
Well, it's a fascinating question because I think the book charts the evolution of Garvey's ideas about leading a Back to Africa movement, because I think initially when he floated the idea, I think it was a metaphor for taking charge of your own personal destiny. I don't think he envisaged a great mass migration of black people to Africa, to Liberia, because I think he rightfully understood that unless you could replicate Harlem in Monrovia, in Liberia, you weren't going to go and get a lot of people who had moved from their relative comfort to the relative discomfort of life in Liberia. And I think what happened was that as the years passed and as his movement began to get more and more into trouble, the idea of the escape to Africa as a metaphor became concrete. And I think he, when he had all these troubles and all these enemies arrayed against him and these people leading the back to the Mugabe Must Go campaign and the authorities were now going to prosecute him, I think the idea of Africa, the beginning of an African empire, was an idea of escape, was escape from his troubles. So his strange arrangement with the Ku Klux Klan was one of expediency, because I think he wanted to show to the authorities at that time in 1924 that he was no great threat. I think he wanted to dip below the radar and therefore the heat would be off. So the sad thing is about Garvey is that this great man of the Back to Africa movement never actually set foot on Africa himself. He was denied passports to go to Africa. And I think I'm at pains in the book to explain that this idea of separation was one that he came to eventually. I don't think it was there initially, even though he proclaimed himself to be the provisional president of Africa, and he thought of his people in his cabinet as a kind of government in exile. I mean, he hadn't asked the opinion of the Africans. I mean, there are lots of people who thought it was a joke. And even people like Claude Mackay thought that Garvey had a very skewed idea about what Africa was in the first place. And so this great accommodation with the Ku Klux Klan was his downfall, but I think he thought that he'd made a kind of fantastic decision. It was almost a coup. I mean, in a way, it was a very brave thing to do, to go into Atlanta and to negotiate with the Ku Klux Klan at a time when they were committing monstrosities against black people and Jewish people and Catholics and Irish people, but mostly against black people. I think he thought, rather like people in this country remember Margaret Thatcher saying that they would never do business with the IRA, they would never do business with so-called terrorists. We now know that they did do business with the IRA. We know that they did do business because they needed to get beyond the conundrum, get beyond the difficulty that they found themselves in. And I think Garvey also felt that one had to make a business, one had to make a pact with the Ku Klux Klan because they were actually the real key force in America. I think it was a mistaken idea, but he thought that they were the real authorities, or otherwise, why would the government permit lynchings to be carried out without any kind of punishment meted out to the perpetrators?
What was the substance of the pact? Did it actually have any effect?
Well, it was never really published. I mean, he said he would publish the actual pact, but I think he realized quite early on that he'd run into a real firestorm. I mean, the great thing about Marcus Garvey, and the unusual thing, and the thing that I really love about him, is that he's a man of great contradictions. Because on the one hand, he's this great speaker who can tap into the submerged thoughts of awakening people. But on the other hand, he has a tin ear. He has a terrible tin ear. He won't listen to anybody. And he makes these mad decisions, and he's going to stick by them, come what may. So we don't actually know what the actual remit of the pact was. But we do know that when he made that pact, some of his followers who were evangelizing, for want of a better word, in the South, were having real difficulties because they were being run out of town by the Ku Klux Klan, in the same way that the evangelizers of the NAACP were being run out of town in the South by the Ku Klux Klan. And so it was a kind of expedient move to allow his people, his representatives, to work without being molested.
And they were calling for people to go back to Africa, which is what I was sort of was seeing earlier, that it was a confluence of some kind of goal in some ways. I have to point out that I understand this is not from a book, but this is from a personal recollection from a family history, that a woman, an African-American woman, told me that part of her family was on a boat that was a back-to-Africa boat that was outfitted by this, not by Garvey, but by this Negro Removal Office, which has this resonance with the Indian Removal Office, but that many of them died. In fact, they had as high a ratio of deaths, maybe higher, on this boat going back to Africa because it wasn't outfitted well enough, as some of the slave ships hadn't coming over.
Hope you read my book, because you've touched on a very fascinating point, because Garvey wasn't the first person to lead this idea of a back to Africa movement. There have been many, many examples of people leading similar movements. Maybe you're referring to the Azor, one of the first ships to go from America to Liberia and Sierra Leone, sponsored by the American Colonization Society. And that on that ship, scores of people did die, and it was a perilous thing to do. So it was a very brave thing to even consider going to Africa. But as I say, Garvey wasn't the first person to come up with this idea, and one of his early predecessors would have been Chief Sam. Chief Sam is a man from Africa who led a movement, the Chief Sam movement, which was also a movement to repatriate black people to Africa.
I'd like to very quickly to try to get in our last caller here, line 3 in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, I just want you to sort of, someone that's very important in African-American history and liberation, as I've always heard contrasted with W.B. Du Bois, and that would be Booker T. Washington, and his accommodationist or vocational training for the advancement of colored people, as opposed to Du Bois' intellectual political activist proposal for the advancement of colored people. How does Marcus Garvey fit into this continuum, starting with Booker T. Washington, going through W.B. Du Bois, and then Marcus Garvey?
Yeah, and I can give you, Mr. Grant, about a minute to answer what is an excellent question. And unfortunately, we're kind of right up against the end of the show.
Well, I would say you're going to have to read the book, because that great triangle is one which I explore, and because Garvey adored Booker T. Washington, and I think he saw himself as the natural successor to Booker T. Washington, and this idea of self-sufficiency, of casting down your bucket where you are and not relying on other people to help you out, to form a kind of unity of purpose. And Garvey, as I say, revered Booker T. Washington, and in the same way that there was a great struggle between Booker T. Washington and Du Bois, there came a great battle subsequently between Du Bois and Garvey.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop, simply because we've come to the end of the time. I would certainly recommend the book. It's titled Negro with a Hat, The Rise and Fall of Marcus Garvey. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. It was first broadcast on March of this past year. And if you are interested in hearing that again, or in fact going back and hearing some of our past programs, other interviews from the Afternoon Magazine, or all of our local production, you can go to the website. It's WILL, that's will.illinois.edu. You can look at our schedules for the week. You can sign up for the podcast, and you can get a lot of information on WILL programming. So that's WILL.illinois.edu. Support for the broadcast today comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll turn to the archives and rebroadcast an interview done earlier this year with science writer Chip Walter. We talked with him about his book, Thumbs, Toes, and Tears, and Other Traits That Make Us Human. That will air this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at the commodity markets in Kansas City. July wheat trading at 937, up 16. September 950, up 14 and a quarter. In Chicago, July wheat 899, up 22 and a half. September 917 and a quarter, up 23. And July corn 737, up 4 and a half. September 751, up 4 and a quarter. December 770 and a half, up 5 and a half. March corn 783 and a quarter, up 6 and a quarter. July soybeans 1557, up 23. August 1560 and a half, up 23. September 1548, up 22. November 1548, up 25. July soybean meal 41510, up 930. July oil 6571, up 6. At the Merck in Chicago, June live cattle 9665, down 7 and a half. August 10425, up 80. August feeder cattle 110.05, up 40. September 112.02 and a half, up 52 and a half. July lean hogs 74.55, up 167 and a half. Outside markets, July crude 133.70, down 91. The CRB index 450.38, up 61. The U.S. dollar 73.53, that is off 8. And the Dow, as of 15 minutes ago, off 84 points at 12,185.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from the Archer Daniels Midland.